Okay, we might begin this afternoon session. We're talking homegrown remedies for global ills, so I welcome you. I want to begin by welcoming our alumni as well as friends and colleagues to this session. We're going to, again, be recording and filming the entire session, including questions and answers, so I do remind you or warn you of that, and also ask you to turn your mobile phones off, please, at this point. We're going to ask each of our speakers to bring some ideas to this session. We will, after each speaker, I'll invite the panel to perhaps continue that discussion if they have specific questions. But we'll work through all three speakers, and then at the end we'll open it up, and we do want to allow at least half an hour, if not a bit more, for your contribution to that conversation. We've had a lot of conversation already and sharing many ideas. We've talked about some of the harsh realities, and I think we have evoked quite a bit of the usual fear discussion that we need to begin these conversations with in order to be reminded of the problem. We've talked a lot about the complexity of the problem and the complexity of the solutions that we need to start to be discussing and implementing to address those. We've talked about the need for not just mitigation but adaptation as we've now committed ourselves to our 1 to 2 degree increase. So in this session, we've been charged with the challenge, if you like, of starting to look at some of those remedies, having the discussion around the ways that we might approach implementation, and in particular, looking at this perhaps at a local level. Living in Australia, particularly in southeastern Australia, we're faced as a marginal environment with looking at some of the most immediate responses to global change in terms of how we live. I'm just going to quote from a book that that I think Rob will talk a bit more about as well, but saying that the national versus international solutions, and we heard this morning the discussion about the need for a global response, an integrated global response, but to think about what this means locally as well. And this is a quote from Garrett Hardin, who's a late bioethicist in the US, who says, "The moral is surely obvious, never globalise a problem if it can possibly be solved locally. Populations, like potholes, are produced locally and, unlike atmospheric pollution, remain local unless some people are so unwise as to globalise them by permitting population excesses to migrate into the better endowed countries." I'll begin by introducing the panel members in reverse order, and I'll introduce them all up front because we will be inviting discussion from all panellists as we go. So first I'll introduce Sana Nakata, who is a 25-year-old. And I put the age in up front, 26 now. Out of date, I'll fix that.
No longer classify as a young Australian.
Okay. Well, she can leave the panel now. So we want to have a young voice. And Sana is a PhD candidate here now at the University of Melbourne, but has been here for some time, having completed her degree with Trinity. And she's now, that was in arts and law, and she's now focusing on her PhD research and children's rights and political philosophy. Sana describes herself as interested, educated, part of the educated population, generation around climate change, and yet to be engaged. In fact, she's put the challenge to us. However, she's a very engaged public member, I must say. During her university studies, she worked at Victoria Legal Aid, the United States House of Representatives, and Department of Premier and Cabinet here in Victoria. So we'll be interested for Sana's perspectives. Rob Moody is a professor here in the Nossal Institute for Global Health, a professor of global health, and chair of the National Preventative Health Task Force. That was his punishment for speaking too loudly and convincingly at Kevin Rudd's 2020 Visioning Summit. He's also acting chair of the Commission of AIDS in the Pacific. Rob came to the University of Melbourne after an extended period as chief executive officer of VicHealth, and currently chairs the technical panel to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation HIV Prevention Program in India. He was inaugural director of country programs at the Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS, and he also chairs the Melbourne Storm Rugby League Club, just to balance Tim Reeves' comments earlier. Okay, and now I'm going to begin, and you have their extended CVs upstairs, and I invite you to have a read of those. Now I'm just going to introduce, to kick our conversation off, Professor Roger Short. Professor Short has shed new light on the causes of the human population explosion, and this is something that has come up again and again in all sessions, beginning last night with Peter Doherty. Roger's been actively involved in contraceptive research and development for 2 decades and is known internationally for his work trialling lemon juice as a contraceptive and anti-HIV microbicide in women. Roger has a distinguished career from 83 to 1983 to 90. Roger was chairman of the US-based Family Health International, one of the world's largest non-government, not-for-profit organisations dedicated to the provisions of family planning services for developing countries. His career includes Foundation Director of the Medical Research Council's Unit of Reproductive Biology in Edinburgh from 1972 to 1982 and so on. He is incredibly passionate about his work and incredibly prolific with over 350 scientific publications, and I invite him to pick up, I guess, where Janet left off. She talked about the history of population growth, and Roger can now talk about where we need to go in the future.
Thank you, Catherine. What a thrill it is to be here. I really feel excited, and I hope I can excite you. They say that the essence of a good lecture is to tell people what you're going to tell them, and tell them what you've told them. So I'm going to talk about population growth as the cause of global warming. And I'm going to tell you we can stop it, because we have a pill that will stop global warming. A pill that will stop global warming. Isn't that fantastic? And I'm going to tell you how we're going to use it. But I'd like to start with my first PowerPoint that is you, the audience, because you're on screen, and I'm going to ask for your participation by raising a hand in answer to this one very simple question. Hands up those of you who have more than one brother or sister. Wow! Population growth? Today is a historic day. Peter Costello submitted his resignation. So from this moment onwards, it's one for mum, one for dad, full stop! And never forget it. Thank you. So let me begin at the beginning with an amazing document that was released on the 11th of March this year by the United Nations Population Division in New York. And in January, I had the good fortune to be sitting next to Dr. Zlotnick, who is the lady who runs that division, and we discussed what this report was going to say. And I'd like to just go through it with you very briefly. I guess the most important thing is to think of the 1st of July, 2 weeks' time, when the population of the world will have gone up to 6.8 billion. 6.8 billion. Not million, billion. When I was born, there were only 2 billion people on Earth. When Malthus was born, and we were hearing about him in the previous session, was only 1 billion people on Earth. So if it's 6.8 billion today, where's it going to stop? Well, according to the UN Population Division, they'll only make predictions up to 2050, and by 2050, there will be 9.1 billion. And that growth is unsustainable. I'll say that once more. That growth is unsustainable. We have to stop it. Jeffrey Sachs, America's leading economist, who's just come out with this lovely book called Commonwealth, as two separate words, says, we cannot afford to let the population of the world go above 8 billion. That's the maximum. So every one of us in this room can do something about that, and I'll give you some suggestions as to what we could do. This report, to read out a few of the things that it says, around 2005, the use of modern contraceptive methods in the least developed countries was as low as 24% among women of reproductive age who were married or in union, and a further 23% of those women had an unmet need for family planning. So we've totally failed to give family planning to the people in the developing world who desperately want it. Why do they need it desperately? Because population growth rates are highest in developing countries, because they've been denied access to contraception. But specifically, it's the women who've been denied that access. And if there's one message I'd like to leave with all of you today, it is that what we must try and do now is to completely feminize the family planning movement. It's women who have babies, not men. And we must absolutely make sure that women the world over, especially in developing countries, have that priority of access whenever they want it to the best of contraceptive methods and the safest methods of terminating a pregnancy. Way back in the mid-1960s, I was very influenced by a professor in Aberdeen, Sir Dougal Baird, alas now dead, who gave an amazing speech, which was subsequently published in the British Medical Journal, and it was called A Fifth Freedom? And what he said was, it was President Roosevelt who in 1942 enunciated the four freedoms, you know, freedom of religion and freedom from want and hunger and health. But he said, I think that the women of the world, deserve a fifth freedom. Freedom from the tyranny of excessive fertility. Amen to that. What an amazing thought. We're talking about the tyranny of having to bear a child that you don't want. No man can understand that, nor can any male religious leader, I beg to submit. So the vast majority, 75%, of women in the developing world, where all the population growth, or almost all of it, is occurring, are denied access to contraceptive methods. And we'll talk a little bit about why they're denied it. But just to go on with this report. I told you that we're 6.8 billion, and we're going to be 9.1 billion by 2050. And if you don't remember anything else from my talk other than the fifth freedom, just remember those two numbers, 6.8, 9.1. And the population of the more developed countries is expected to increase slightly between now and 2050 from 1.23 billion as it is today, to 1.28 billion. So the developed countries are almost stable, except for the United States of America. And Barack Obama, wonderful guy. I was in the States in Berkeley on the day of his inauguration. And it was as if the whole of the United States rose 10 feet out of the water. Fantastic, so exciting. And I'm 100% behind Obama. But here's the problem he's got. The population of the United States at the moment is 307 million. But it has an extremely high immigration rate, especially from Mexico. And a recent report by Christopher Jenks, a Harvard professor, published in the New York Review of Books in two volumes, in two succeeding issues, Christopher Jenks had this article entitled, "Who Should Get In?" And we need an article like that written from Australia, "Who Should Get In?" Because it's a critical question for all of us. And what Jenks says is that it's quite probable that from the 307 million today, by 2050, the United States could well be half a billion. And if that's the case, English will have become a minority language in the United States. Hasta la vista. Think of the implications of that. Staggering. And back to Jeffrey Sachs and Commonwealth. In his opening chapter in the book, which was just published last year, he says, "The dominance of the United States in world affairs is over." We turn the page and we open it to China. China is the nation of the future. Let's give them a clap. Because I think that's so exciting. And what a change for us. And here we are, sort of positioned to actually play a part in that. So just to continue with this, the population of the 49 least developed countries is the fastest growing in the world. So the poorest have got the highest population growth rates. And many children make you poor. You get caught in the poverty trap because many children will never make you wealthy, as some of us in this room know all too well. And just a couple of further points, that high population growth rates prevail in many developing countries, and some of the highest population rates are in Afghanistan, Niger, Somalia, Timor-Leste, and Uganda, whose population growth rates are going to be, by 2050, over 150%. I've lived in Uganda. I spent 6 months of my life in Uganda, in a mud hut. One of the highlights of my life. And to see the population growing like that, so sad. And during the period 210 to 250, nine countries will account for half of the world's population. India, Pakistan, Nigeria, Ethiopia, the United States of America, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Tanzania, China, and Bangladesh. Poor, that's amazing, isn't it? That's half the world's population. Australia? Doesn't count. And there's good news, because amongst the most populous developing countries, there are some whose fertility is already below replacement level. They are China, Brazil, Vietnam, Iran. Three cheers for Iran. What an amazing achievement. All we hear is sort of mud and dirt about Iran. But they've managed, through women's action, to actually get their population growth under control. And if any of you have not read the book, Dr. Farman Farmian's Daughter of Persia is the most amazing account of how one single young Iranian girl could get the first family planning clinic going in Tehran. And it's worked. And Thailand and the Republic of Korea are the other two on the list. So that's the international challenge. Now, what's Australia's challenge? Well, Catherine introduced you to this wonderful book, which is on sale in the bookshop upstairs. It's called Overloading Australia, and it's by a wonderful man who I've only just met, Mark O'Connor, who is a poet based in Canberra. And this is a fantastic account of what's wrong with Australia, how governments and media dither and deny on population. You try and get population into any of the media, it's absolutely a non-issue. They don't want to hear about it. You look at the 2020 summit, several of us made submissions to talk about future population growth in Australia. Rejected. Population was not going to be discussed at 2020. And I don't think he's been able to come here this afternoon because he's got a conflicting meeting. But Barry Jones is my hero. Because Barry chaired this amazing all-party Senate Select Committee on Australia's population carrying capacity. And this was back in 1994, published in December 1994, which said that they took extensive public opinions from over 200 people. I made a submission to them. And they concluded that the vast majority of Australians want the population to stabilise at between 22 and 23 million. We do not, economists, please listen, we do not want growth. We want stability, not growth. How can we get that message across? Why didn't Barry Jones's Senate Select Committee end up in some political consequences? It's all there in print. Every word of it is absolutely true, and you'll find it all picked up very beautifully in Mark O'Connor's book. So the first thing we could do is if everyone in this room wrote or signed a one-paragraph letter to the most notorious anti-population newspaper in Australia, The Australian, or even worse, The Weekend Australian. I'm about to cancel my subscription. And we sent off a letter signed by 200 of you saying, why don't we implement the findings of the Senate Select Committee of 1994, December 1994, and have a population policy for Australia. At the moment, Australia's population is growing at a fantastic rate. I won't go into the great details, but on the 11th of May, Australian government website said that on the 11th of May we were 21,756,000, and Australia's population is increasing by one person every 1.5 minutes. One person every 1.5 minutes is added to the existing population. Almost all of that is from immigration. And the Department of Immigration has its own reasons for doing that, which are mostly commercial. And Barry Jones's committee said we should stabilise Australia's migrants, and everyone in this room is a migrant, so we're all in the same boat, and we all got in somehow. We should stabilise the number of migrants to no more than 50,000 a year. It's very difficult to find out from the Department of Immigration what the current immigration rate is, but it's rather than 50,000, it's over 130,000, and I heard a rumour that it's actually gone up to 180,000. But we're never told about this, nor is the Prime Minister. We want a population committee chaired by the Prime Minister to see that Australia has a stable population in the years to come. Now, I've got one very quick message, because I said I'd give you something to go home with. What can we do about it? Australia's got the second or third highest teenage pregnancy rate in the developed world. America's number one, and we're, depending on whose figures you look at, two or three. It's a disgrace. Why? Because we don't talk about sex in schools. So, here in the University of Melbourne, last week, our medical students, led by James Hillis, a final year medical student, produced this amazing resource book, which is called Teach the Teacher. And this is now being handed out to all the education students in Melbourne University, and it's produced by the medical students in Melbourne University. The cost of this initiative in the University of Melbourne, so that we produce a whole generation of teachers who know everything that there is to know about sex and contraception, the cost was precisely zero. And these students, they've done something fantastic. So let me finish. We know that global warming, from David Carroll's talk this morning, we're absolutely sure that it is due, it's a human artifact, and we're the global warmers. And particularly in the wealthy developed countries, we are particularly the global warmers. The United States is the most affluent and the most effluent nation on Earth. They've got to stop it, and we've got to stop it, and we can stop it. Because if we could give women of the world power and access to contraception, they would have the wisdom to only have small families. Thank you.
I actually want to take you on a journey, and it starts on a train. About a month ago, a young 20-something man gingerly rose to his feet in a crowded suburban train. The only one standing, he nervously introduced himself, declaring that he'd decided to face one of his fears every day, and that one of his greatest fears was speaking in front of people. He encouraged others to do the same. He sat down, and an initial silence was followed by a bellowed thank you from the back of the train, loud applause, and much commuter conversation on the way into Flinders Street. As a nation and as a globe, we have many fears and ills that confront us. For example, climate change, disconnection and isolation, declining physical activity, overweight, inequity and discrimination. If we're to have active, connected, fair, safe, economically and socially productive communities that tread lightly on our planet, this will require not insignificant cultural shifts. Cultural shifts in the way that we treat our planet, in the way that we treat each other, in the way that we treat ourselves, and in the way we build our cities and towns. And that's what I'd like to talk about today. Active, connected, fair, safe, economically and socially productive communities that tread lightly on our planet. I obviously want a lot. To do so, we need more people in trains, metaphorically at least, standing up to confront our fears and our ills. But we can actually solve many of these problems together. Climate change and declining physical activity are two obvious starters. We have the paradox of burning too much fossil fuel, but not burning enough of our own personal fuel. So we can start our very own personal carbon trading scheme. Out of the car and off the couch at every opportunity, for example. We've been lulled into a false sense of sedentariness. We have another paradox in that, say, 100 years ago, we had to stop our labours every so often to rest. Now, because sitting still for long periods actually increases our risks of heart disease, we actually have to get up every few hours and move. Getting very simple physical activity back into our lives is not difficult, but it does require individual and cultural mind shifts. Climb the stairs. That's if you can find them. So any architects here, please, please redesign them back into our buildings. Make shopping caddies cool. Walk or bike to school, uni or work. Walk up escalators. Even stand at meetings. Anybody who wants to get up now, please feel free to do so. Learn where the bus, train, tram and routes go and how you can use them. It just means using the car and the lift a little less. It doesn't mean you actually have to sell a car. But it does mean the car has to share with buses, trams, pedestrians and cyclists. I must tell you the Vic Roads pedestrian safety strategy. And Vic Roads, in a sense, used to, and probably still does, rule the roost in terms of how we actually allocate our resources for transport. But the Vic Roads pedestrian safety strategy, when we sat down with the boss to find out what it was really all about, it was fundamentally designed to have no pedestrians. If you had no pedestrians, you had no accidents. So, but this is actually what they were trying to design, which does seem a little ridiculous. Now, who here owns a push mower? Well done. No noise, no fossil fuel, just using your own personal fuel. They're incredibly easy to use, actually. We can even go so far as the Cooper's beer ad says, cut your emissions and walk to the pub. To me, this is multitasking at its most creative. The design of our cities and towns must go sub-suburban by creating and recreating local villages, what I would call metropolets, where we can get to shopping, food, recreation, entertainment and schooling on foot. Local kindergartens and primary schools are the glue in many communities. They allow parents to meet and mix, as do local shops and sports and arts facilities. And at the same time, we get to see and even talk to others on the way, giving us a sense of local identity, local connection, and a greater sense of safety as more people repopulate our streets. But we do suffer the inverse care law. Those with less get less, and those with more get more. So investing in creating new metropolets is all the more important in those areas that have the least, where people have to travel the furthest to work and where there are the fewest amenities. There's been much debate about Melbourne 2030, the grand urban plan for Melbourne, and the recent expansion of the urban growth boundary. We seem continually keen to expand the city limits, making Melbourne, the world's eighth least dense city, even less dense, and therefore harder to provide services, and in the process, increasing our carbon footprint rather than decreasing it. Expanding the urban growth boundary is like managing overweight by getting a bigger belt. We said at the Australian Summit, and Roger mentioned it, that by 2020, and last year, that we want Australia to be known throughout the world for its diverse, compassionate, fair, and respectful society. And to do that, I think we have to create connections and understanding, not only across ethnic divides, but across social, geographic, and economic divides. As much between Chardonnay-sipping armchair intellectuals and beer-swilling bogans as between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians and between remote and urban Australians. This calls for social innovations to bridge these divides, having common projects, schools connecting, local communities connecting, simply getting to know each other, diminishing the fear of the unknown other. In my opinion, the most powerful driver of racism and discrimination. Ensuring that we can all share our assets as much and as evenly as possible. Ensuring that everyone lives and experiences the fair go. Ensuring that from our oldest inhabitants to the newest arrivals, everybody gets maximum support and encouragement to learn the tools for surviving and thriving. Language, jobs, education, sport, culture, while having reciprocal opportunities to contribute economically, socially and culturally to the evolving mosaic of our Australian life. We are fundamentally social beings who seek connection and social supports to thrive. Just witness Mary and Max in Adam Elliott's latest movie. And this need is not without reason. It's been consistently demonstrated that those who are socially isolated or disconnected from others have between 2 and 5 times the risk of dying from all causes compared to those who maintain strong ties with family, friends, and community. Inclusive, supportive, connected societies can be real lifesavers. So as some forms of association decline, such as church going, scouts and guides, some of the trade unions, we must adapt more creatively to both stem this decline and to invent new forms of association based on recreation, sport, spirituality, cultural interests, commerce or work. Much is made of the need for continuing technological innovation to improve our lives and cure global ills. But to maximise the advantage that these innovations bring, be it information technology, internet, SMS, or passive entertainment such as e-games and video, then we need to participate in the change to adapt our lives actively, not just be passive subjects of the innovations. Often we place great hope in technological solutions, and Peter Doherty referred to the giant strides we have made in recent years. But there will never be a magic bullet to replace the need for physical activity. I can guarantee this. Technology might help us in achieving our required levels of activity, but just like climate change, we actually need to do the hard yards, so to speak, ourselves, as individuals, families, communities, and nations. We can be the masters of technology, not just the sedentary servants. If we don't, we risk being turned into big-bummed, tiny-brained humanoids with large fingers and thumbs for adjusting the remote control. And at the same time, we can improve some existing technologies to protect our planet, such as even making simply video conferencing as user-friendly as possible, thus helping to reduce our carbon-heavy frequent flyer miles. We'll always need the face-to-face contact, but global warming air miles can be limited. Our Earth has become a complex place to be. We are too time poor for one solution at a time, and we must look to solving several at one go. Bring on multitasking to save the planet, improve livability, and enhance health. And just like the young man who stood up on the train, we can solve some of our own fears and inspire others while travelling to work. Thank you.
Key points about active adaptation rather than passive is an important one, because that's what we're trying to now, I guess, look to when we're looking at perhaps even bite-sized solutions, but to roll them out, but to actually, I guess, not be responding and directing our own future. I think it's interesting, though, one of the points you raised reminds me of some of the discussions around global emissions and some of the things in place that we thought might reduce carbon emissions, including improved communication, so that you can now Skype meetings with people all around the world with virtual face-to-face that we thought might take some of that pressure off. But there's almost been a perverse outcome. I don't think it's documented, but in talking to people involved in that kind of interaction, that it has led to sometimes more relationships being built that then require people to travel more.
Well, another even better one is the paperless office.
Yeah.
And we've never had a greater capacity to actually print out as much stuff and use as much paper than we have now. And I mean, it's an absolute perverse outcome of what was intended.
Yeah.
Thinking of the previous session and the problems of agriculture, I always have in the back of my mind that lovely quote from Isaiah, chapter 58, "All flesh is grass." What an amazing, profound statement. Because we need plants to actually convert solar energy into something that can be our source of energy. Would you now be a vegetarian?
I am.
Actually, I didn't realise that.
Yeah. I am a vegetarian, and I actually haven't done it for climate change reasons, but I just read the document that was handed out to us and thought that's not a bad idea then. But I mean, it's it's a long way to go. And that's why India is such a great place to go and eat, because restaurants are they're vegetarian and non-vegetarian. Here, the sort of the opportunities of being vegetarian or to eat are much less. But it's not in our national psyche yet that it's even really an acceptable way to view our food. I mean, I have many friends who help rear pigs and cattle, and it's been so much part of our tradition that it's going to be very hard to change.
One of the other things that you raised was about how we, which link into, I think, some of the questions Sana had for the panel also, about how we implement, but how you do get that culture change, that shift, and we talked before about this idea of shopping caddies and making them fashionable, and I was talking to one of our local designers, Catherine Manuel, who's linked that fashion and function together in her own work and has, I guess, similar discussions around multitasking. That's the way we view it. But how do we actually get that to permeate further? Is that something that's still in one sector of our community? Is it something that's still a privileged idea that we can have the time or the money to...
Sure. I mean, a way you design the local community is really important about how people use them. If they don't have to travel a long way to work, it's quite different if you've got things locally there for you. But, I mean, how we get cultural change happens in many, many different ways. But I was talking this morning to a guy, Jack Fuller, who's looking at this whole issue of choice architecture and how do we actually move ourselves to more creative behaviours or healthier behaviours. And we have a lot to learn from the advertising industry because many of our behaviours and the way that can be changed, they're doing it all the time. It's not a sort of a passive playing field out there. There's a lot of active change going on in our culture. A lot of it's actually associated with making money, which is absolutely legitimate. But I think we have to learn a little bit more about how we get, in a sense, you know, making money out of healthy, creative, sustainable solutions.
I'm actually not up here to talk about any particular local remedies. I want to use this opportunity to think a little bit about how it is that we think about our relationships and connection to land. And I wanted to start by asking who here is familiar with the story of Tiddalik the frog? Yeah, so a few people. I'm going to tell you very quickly this story and then I'll explain to you why and some of the ideas in that story that I really like. And I want to lead that into a conversation around how I've come to think about my connection to land as one about being borrowed land and how that shapes my sense of responsibility, perhaps, of how I engage with land and community. Tiddalik was the largest frog in all the land. This is an Aboriginal story, not an island story, but it's just one that I grew up with. And he, one day he's really, really thirsty, he has an unquenchable thirst, and he starts to drink from his swamp and the rivers around and then all of the lakes until there's no fresh water left anywhere. And the animals begin to suffer and they begin to die and the trees and the shrubs start to wilt. And everyone becomes deeply concerned about this. And eventually an old wombat suggests that perhaps if they could get Tiddalik to laugh, he'd no longer be able to hold all of that water in him and it would all come, you know, pouring back out into where it should be. And so all of the animals start trying to entertain Tiddalik, and there's a kangaroo that jumps over an emu and there's no reaction, and a goanna up on his hind legs poking out his belly and no reaction, and the kookaburras telling their funniest jokes but no reaction. And eventually Nubanum, an eel, comes wriggling out of a dry riverbed that he'd lived in and starts to dance, and he's dancing faster and faster. And as he's dancing faster and faster, he starts to tie himself up into knots in all sorts of shapes. And of all things, this is what, you know, manages to crack a smile on Tiddalik's face, and his eyes light up and he starts to laugh. And all of a sudden, all of this water comes gushing out of Tiddalik and all of the swamps and the rivers and the lakes are filled with water again. I tell this story not because of its obvious suggestions about good water management, perhaps, but because I recalled having a conversation a number of years ago with a group of people about the drought, and I made a passing reference to this story. I think I commented something like, well, who's going to make Tiddalik laugh now? And no one got it. No one knew what I was talking about. And I would have been 20, but that was the first moment in my life where I realised that not everyone knew that story. And I find it interesting, perhaps just in a passing way, that we might be so familiar with the stories of Little Red Riding Hood, and yet the story of Tiddalik in Australia is perhaps far less common, when it speaks so much more to the experience and the world that Australian kids grow up in. There are two more particular things about that story that I really like, and one is about the narrative it offers about risk in relationship to land, which stands in quite stark contrast to the more colonial European narratives that we are familiar with, and the idea of Australia being a vast and desolate land that's lacking and perhaps a very risky place for those of us who try to inhabit it or tame it. And this is a story about a land that is whole and sustaining in and of itself, and that the only risk in that land is actually in the way that we manage it, or perhaps in Tiddalik's misunderstanding of his relationship to that land. And that goes again to the idea of custodianship, which is such a significant part of how many Indigenous people understand their relationship and connection to land. And I'm not here to suggest that there's anything new or different or unique in these attitudes or connections to land. I don't know enough about Indigenous relationships to land to be able to talk about it. I grew up in Townsville in Adelaide and spent nearly 10 years living in the inner city here in Melbourne, so I don't know what it's like to be on country. But I guess I've always grown up with that in my world, of that idea of land and connection to land in my world. And I see those sorts of connections, I think, in all sorts of places. And Rob mentioned them in a description of high streets that are thriving, that allow people to engage with one another in public spaces, in schools, on trains, that there is a way of experiencing the environment that we live in through people and through community, and that there's a sense of belonging that comes out of that. My mum likes to think that my sister and I and my father, who's an islander, have an Indigenous sense of land in our ability to be anywhere and find food on a tree or in a park. We can't go anywhere. We can't walk through Carlton Gardens without looking to see if there are berries and herbs and things in places. And all of the road trips I ever took as a child, Dad screaming down the highway and then suddenly pulling over under a tree, seemingly in the middle of nowhere, only to show us what was on the shrubs. I don't know if that's an Indigenous thing. My dad wouldn't suggest, I think, that that's an Indigenous connection to land. I think he would say, he has said, that that's just us paying attention and mum not. But for me, I see that in other places too. I see that mum, there was, when we lived in Adelaide, a grand old River Red Gum in the middle of the road, because the road had been built quite literally around it. And that's about a connection to land. That's about a community that stands up and says, we want this tree kept, and of decision makers who can also see the value in that. For me, it's the lifesavers on our beaches that have taught generations of young Australians to enjoy the water, but also to respect the water and understand its power so that we can be safe, but also to be able to enjoy it. So I see it everywhere. I mean, I see it in Melbourne Layways and in all of the reasons why this place I call home, even though this is not my land. And I guess I want to come then to the idea that in all of these things, in all of these connections that we have to land in different ways, that there's a value in it that allows us to belong to that place. And my sense of connection to land is not a connection to my traditional lands because I didn't grow up there, but a connection to land that wherever I go in the world, I know that I stand on borrowed country. And I don't need an acknowledgement to country at the beginning of public events to realise that. That is a part of how I inhabit this world, is with that knowledge that I stand on a borrowed place that exists the way that it exists because of all of the people who have come before me and because of the way in which they have cared for and taken responsibility for this place. It is a connection to land, I think, that is inherently flexible and able to be transformed and changed, not just according to what we need, but deeply rooted in the sense that it belongs not to me, but that I belong to it. And I guess that's the idea of connection to land that we often hear from Indigenous people. And I guess I just want to leave you with the thought about how thinking about land and connection to land in these ways might change the way we think about our relationship and our role in it. Because for me, as Catherine mentioned, I'm not particularly engaged in climate change, and I try to make good decisions and I try to be aware of my impact on the earth. But I'm one of those people that gets a little bit overwhelmed by all of the information and of not really knowing what to do with it all. But I guess it's the sense that it doesn't have to be a burden, that when you have a sense that you stand on borrowed country and on borrowed land and that it's a privilege to be there and that it's an amazing kind of history that brings you to that place and allows you to enjoy it in these ways, that being a part of it, it becomes a pleasure, a real pleasure and an enjoyable kind of privilege to be the next in line, to stand as one among many of new custodians for the next generation and for those who will follow us, not just in terms of future generations, but in terms of when I leave my neighbourhood and go to move somewhere else and have to pick up and go to a different land and build different connections and a different sense of belonging to a place. I don't know how much is in those sorts of ideas, but I have a background in sort of political philosophy, so I'm inclined to those more abstract thoughts. And I guess I like to think that in this country, we've been thinking about connection to land and our relationship to land for tens of thousands of years already. And even since the experience of colonisation, I can see in so many different ways in Australian society today that we are still always thinking about those connections to land. And that if we can start to value and recognise it as more than just romantic storytelling or nostalgia, but something quite purposeful and functional, that it might help us to be more excited about the actions that we undertake to initiate change rather than daunted by them. So that's the thought that I want to leave you with today. Thanks very much.
And again, that key word around action and activity. And I think it's interesting because a lot of people generalise about the Aboriginal history as one that's very passive and low impact, but it's not. There have been major changes to the landscape with the way people have lived with the land, but it is a very integrated part to the whole knowledge system and thought process and active management.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't know a lot about it, but in many ways it's the operating foundation of knowledge. Which I think is quite, you know, you can distinguish that perhaps from more Western knowledges. But I like to try and look for the commonalities that we have in our more mainstream practices to be able to say, well, we do have connections to land in the way that we move about our high streets. And we do have connections to land in the way that we visit the beach and go hiking and are active. But that we often think of those things as good for the soul or spiritual. Those things are very important. we can also think about them as something more purposeful, I think, or functional.
And I think that ties back to early discussions that you don't have to be unhealthy, you don't have to be impoverished to be having a low carbon footprint on the planet. And what you're saying is you don't have to be unhappy, that this is about the challenges turning into opportunities, but tapping into those things that are already very positive parts of the human experience and building on those. And
it's
same with community.
Thinking upstairs, the ecologically designed community, the tagline is live better, consume less. And I think that's a way that we can start to look at the way we lead our lives. It doesn't... We can have better lives rather than less lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
Well, I'm keen to open up the discussion to the audience. And I'm just going to lose my mic pack now. I've had technical problems. And we might just go back to our slideshow, which was capturing, I guess, some of the images and comments that have come through in people's presentations today as a backdrop, as we invite you to contribute your thoughts. I just ask you to keep your questions brief, and we'll take questions in sequence. So, gentlemen there, and then just in front.
Just to echo that point from Sana about aspects of Indigenous cosmology which we can embrace. Some years ago, I was involved in a project in the Blue Mountains near Sydney, where the local Gundagala people were strongly advocating the idea that communities of people could adopt a totem species a plant or animal to provide a refuge for. And of course, this could happen in the city as much as anywhere else, but the idea being that in understanding the needs of that particular animal and plant and all of its obvious habitat, ecosystems, and extending beyond the local to how that animal experienced the world, we can learn so much about providing refuge, care, and a different relationship with the non-human, or some people call it more than human world. So I wonder what your thoughts are on this idea, of this flexible notion of a special relationship to look after, provide refuge for another being.
I really like it, actually, and it just made me smile because my father's in the islands we have a totem system as well. I don't know my totem. I didn't grow up in community, but my father's totem is the crocodile. And a few years ago, he was in Darwin and ate crocodile for dinner, and afterwards he got stenosis in his neck, which was quite, serious. And my mother just looked at him and she's like, it's because you ate your crocodile. but I do, I think that totem system in the Torres Straits, I'm not sure how much it's actually practiced these days, but it coincides with a broader understanding about the balance of the ecosystem, and that you don't take more than you need, and that everyone in the community understands the role of those animals. And it's a very different way of eating, I guess. All of those animals are consumed animals. But it creates an appreciation, I guess, of what the land is, and that you're there to serve it rather than the other way around.
An appreciation, but with obligation. And I guess that's the thing with the totems as well. So there was another question just in front.
It's a question for Professor Short. You referred to the to tyranny of fertility. May I be so bold as to suggest that quite a few women would disagree with that statement, especially ones suffering from infertility. I was just wondering what your thoughts are on the IVF technology, which is a very expensive technology, which is and highly subsidised by the government.
Sorry, do you want to just repeat?
Essentially, the question is what your thoughts are on the IVF technology.
Yes, thank you for asking that question. It's a very important one. When IVF, Louise Brown, was first born in Edinburgh, I had to preach the sermon in St. Giles Cathedral that weekend on the beginning of life. Amazing occasion. And it really made me think, well, it's great that women who have been unable to have children now can have them. And one thinks of that lovely quote from the Bible again, and some there be which have no memorial, who have perished as though they had never been. And those maybe are the infertile. So IVF, an amazing advance. But when we see what we saw last year, this poor woman in California giving birth to octuplets, I mean, the doctor who did that should be deregistered. And to go to those excesses are just absolutely crazy. So IVF within limits, fantastic. And let's say that, you know, every birth should be a wanted birth, but don't abuse IVF procedures by through wanting to have high fertility rates, transferring 2, 3, 4, 5 embryos, giving lots of twins and triplets, which is still going on in quite a few countries. That is, I think, something that should be stopped.
There's another question about halfway up, and then another one down the front here, and then up there.
Saka, it seems to me that we recent immigrants, and I'm a third generation Australian, but very recent immigrant, regard this country as the source of our income, something out of which we can take our living, we can derive our living from it. There's no sense, and I would like to understand how you feel as though you're owned by the country, you are part of the country, it's not simply something that you make money out of.
I don't know, and I'm actually, you know, I'm reluctant sometimes, I think, to ascribe it to an Indigenous sense of country because I didn't grow up on my country. So that sense that I have, it's just come from my parents teaching me that. And I have a white mother and an Indigenous father. So there is something different for Indigenous people who grow up on land. They have a profoundly different sense of country from me. But I do think that's right. I mean, I think all around the world there are examples of cultures that do have that attitude towards land as resource and income producing. But I think everywhere you can also find examples of where people don't think like that. And for all of the criticism that, or all the things we can say about certain farming and agricultural practices in Australia, I think, you know, it would be very hard to suggest that the families who farm that land over generations don't have in themselves a very deeply intimate and knowledgeable connection to that land. And practices change, and they wouldn't give up on their land. They, you know, perhaps you just need easier ways of being able to transform what the practices are. But for me, it's about just changing the way we think, I guess, about land. And that if you can see your connection to land in a different way, that maybe it becomes something more than just income producing.
And I think it was interesting, the profound effect that the February bushfires had on perhaps the way people also recognise how we are attached to land, place and community in ways that we may not have all acknowledged either. So I think, it's sort of reflecting on some of those times where we view our environment differently and then trying to build on those, understand those and operate more globally in that way.
I certainly think we all have a sense of belonging to land, but perhaps because of the Indigenous way of articulating that connection to land is a little bit more out there, you know, that I can articulate my connection to land because I have an Indigenous history that gives me a way of talking about it. I think everyone has that sense of belonging to land, but that perhaps as a country we just don't talk about it in those ways.
Now, the next question I think was, there's one up the back there and another one down the front here. Yeah.
My question's to Professor Short. Whilst I agree with a lot of what you say, including what you said about, including my your comments about economists, the Malthusian projection of 9.1 billion by 2050 seems to me a little misleading, since the projections are that it's leveled off at that level by 2050. What are your comments on that?
When you actually question the people who produce that report as to what are the error limits, they say, well, they're very considerable. It could be much lower than 9.1. It could be, I think, 8.5 is their lowest. And it could be, I think, as high as 10.2. So there's a big error, which is difficult to factor in, because the 9.1 is based on the assumption that more and more people in the developing world will desire to decrease the size of their families. And so it's factored in that there will be an increasing uptake of contraception of some sort. But we don't know that. So all these forward estimates are really quite iffy. I don't know if that answers your question. I'm afraid I'm a bit like Julius Caesar. This ear is deaf.
Next question.
My name's Ian Blair. I've got two questions for Rob Moody. One, the description of your little suburb sounds very much like the Transition Towns project, and if you could comment on that. And the other one about training, and I've got an ulterior motive. My son runs gyms. What's your comment about making supervised training part of the Medicare medical services?
I'll attack the second one first, because I'm not quite sure if I know about Transition Towns. But this is, in fact, something that the National Preventative Health Task Force, we're meant to be delivering our strategy to the minister in two weeks, in fact, is looking at in terms of what are the incentives that you can provide that will, in a sense, keep people more active and get them more active at all stages of life, from virtually from cradle to grave. And there's no doubt, with the economists in the room, behavioral economics is an important part of the way that we see things, and giving incentives either from the virtue of tax incentives or levies or direct taxes to discourage particular behaviours. One of the issues around that, it's a bit like also FBT on cars, is that it tends to really target those who are better off in the community. So you can say it's a regressive form of taxation. I actually think that we need to introduce some of these things simply to get our minds, to get cultural shifts starting. And the whole notion that you should have a car and the more you drive it, the more you get off your tax is now ridiculous. It doesn't matter who it actually impacts upon. It should be, it shouldn't be there. But actually working out the what are the desired effects, how they actually happen, there's still actually quite a bit more work to be done. There is an opportunity in the Henry Review, and we've certainly asked them to look at that, how we can incentivise, to use that terrible verb that came in about 15 years ago, more active behaviour. Transition towns?
Grassroots, where the community... Rob Hopkins has got 100 towns in UK, and he's got about 20 going in Australia. Sydney's one of them. And it's of grassroots up, setting targets and then going for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think anything, and we've seen this from even local banking, that where you can actually provide different opportunities for people to actually engage. That's why I was saying we have to be quite clever in looking at different ways that we can form association, given that it's an important part of our mental, emotional, physical health. And I think, we've had lots in the previous century. Some of those are changing. We have to be smart enough to pick up new ways of allowing people, encouraging people to belong and associate.
So we've got one and then two.
Just to follow up on that report that's being submitted in 2 weeks, how much encouragement is there going to be for cycling and for things like undercover bicycle parks everywhere possible around the city and suburbs?
Lots. No, I can't, not that I could say what's going to happen, but I mean, one of the challenges, of course, with these sorts of approaches is actually, you know, for a federal government to get down to the local level, and the whole notion of including local governments into these is a challenge. And if there are three levels of government, sometimes we don't necessarily need the one in the middle.
There was someone down the front as well, was there? Oh, sorry, halfway up, and then down the front.
Yes, look, my question's just about something that was started earlier this afternoon, food production, nutrition and sort of public health. And we bring into the population factors and the demands on world production of food and so on. And thinking about that with some eminent people from the medical profession, what is the medical profession's position? What are they doing and how are they active in this whole area of nutrition, public health, obesity, and so on, from perhaps on a world scale, but also on a local scale, and also in terms of what sort of foods we should be producing and what we should be doing about it. So my question is really, you know, where is the medical profession in all of this? Thanks.
I'm the only one. I think I mean, the profession is very broad. I mean, I don't necessarily think the medical profession is leading in the area of nutrition. I think that now that we're just seeing some of the huge challenges about sort of food security combined with producing sustainable production of food, transport of food. These are really very complex systems. I mean, Australia does not really, we still don't have a sort of a food policy, if you like, such to, which is really looking from farm to plate. We in fact need to be able to do that much better. I mean, it's, if I even think of the fact that we don't necessarily encourage in our major children's hospital to have local food being actually sold and produced, you know, used in that area. No, it's a major food chain that's selling its wares. To me, that is pretty ridiculous. Your question's got so many parts to it, but I think that it's not necessarily, I'm from the medical profession, not necessarily coming out of from us. I think the leadership is in around nutrition is coming from a much broader community base, and parents and mothers are actually probably our best guides to what our future nutrition system should be, actually. Rog?
Could I just add to that from another dimension? I was fascinated in the previous session and wanted to ask a question there. In November 2006, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, FAO, issued an amazing six-page document on the global warming gas emissions from animals and showed that cattle and sheep are emitting at both ends more CO2 and methane than the exhausts of all the motor vehicles in the world. Staggering. And they go on, and this is FAO saying this, and they go on to say the first priority must be to halve the world's population of cattle and sheep because they do so much damage. And to link to our previous conversation, I mean, I'm delighted that Rob is a vegetarian. One of my daughters is, and I've always sort of poo-pooed her, but I now think that she's right. And I think we've got to start, really reducing our meat consumption. And
what a challenge for Australian agriculture if we got rid of the sheep and got rid of the cows. We wouldn't need any further remissions for global warming. We could go on burning coal if we had no cows and sheep.
But the point there, I think, is interesting, is the time between actually knowing something and actively doing something about it, the lag time, if you look at between when Dol and Pito discovered the link between tobacco and lung cancer, and then it wasn't really in Australia, say, until the 70s and the 80s that we really started to do something about it. I mean, what Roger's suggesting there, you know, what's evidence-based policy? Everybody talks about evidence-based policy. Well, apply that evidence-based policy to the Australian psyche and the way that we've used the land and reared cattle and sheep for 150 years, and it's a battle. It's a political, it's an issue of political philosophy and political economics, but it needs to be had.
And that pipeline issue is an important one, because as we start to become more active and look for ways to implement change and do that systematically and evidence-based, we're still going to be dealing with the increasing effects of past crimes and omissions. So it's going to be that hard challenge of doing better and suffering the consequences of previous inactivity and delay to activity.
Walk to the pub.
Walk to the pub. We've got one and two down the front here, and then three over here, and then that might take us.
Thank you. My question is to Professor Short. Approaches to tackling excessive population growth have varied from the extreme of, say, the Chinese and the Vietnamese, which have government-administered programs that dictate that you can have one or two children and when you can have them, and punishing you if you break those quotas, to the USAID approach, which will flood a country with contraceptives. Both approaches are roundly criticised. What would you recommend for tackling excessive population growth?
It's an interesting question, and I would grasp the nettle and say that China may be the example that we've all got to think about following. China may be able to relax its one-child family policy in the near future back to a two-child policy. And I've been very impressed talking to some young Chinese girls recently in Beijing and asking them what they think about the one-child family policy. Do they feel it's a denial of their rights? And they say, good heavens, no. It's been the most liberating thing that's ever happened, because suddenly we are the equal of men, because we can compete with them for any job that you like, because we're not tied down to a family. So I think that when you go to China and you think that the one-child family policy came in the early 1980s, it's been enormously successful. And successful in a very interesting way. There's some evidence now beginning to appear from a variety of sources. One of them, Lord Robert May, I guess Australia's leading scientist who is based in Oxford, showing that if you look at the demographics of a population, if you've got a pyramidal population with a large number of young people and relatively few old people, that is terrorism. If you look at Palestine, 50% of the population of Palestine is under the age of 16. So you've got these young, uneducated, unemployable, testosterone-driven young men who all they can do, we would do the same thing, is fight the system. China is guaranteed political stability in the future, whereas Pakistan is a disaster, so is Palestine, and India is going to be in really severe trouble. And there are about three very big publications that have just come out on this, including a great book called Sex and War, which came out just before Christmas by Malcolm Potts, which documents this very, very precisely. If you've got a pyramidal age structure with large numbers of young people, you are in for trouble.
So I want to thank our panel for raising some hope and optimism about the way humans can live and can behave and can take those responsibilities in a way that could be an uplifting part of our future, not just something that's a burden of our recent past. I think for me personally, as a teaching and research academic here at the university, I take great optimism and hope from our postgraduate students. Just plugging our programs now, I'm with the Melbourne School of Population Health and the Office of Environmental Programs, and you'll find some descriptions of some of our courses outside as well. But when we meet the future generations, help train them and expose them to thinkers like this so that they do emerge into practice as informed citizens, then we do hope that we get the best of that humans can contribute. So thank you very much for your participation, and thank you to the panel.